I agree. This is a podcast of the cinema.
True, Linoleum Knife is a podcast of the cinema. What's your name?
I'm Alonzo Duralde. I'm the film reviews editor for The Wrap and a film critic for What the Flick on the Young Turks Network on YouTube. And you, sir?
Why don't you turn your enthusiasm down, like, just a tiny...
Please,
just you should a tiny little mouth.
I let
just a little sliver. Like,
I let Bibbs like introduce the Gotham segment of What the Flick this week, and he went into full like morning zoo crew mode.
Did he do that?
Hey,
did he do that as a goof, or did he do it because sometimes that's what Bibbs does?
It's hard to say. One never really knows with Bibbs. It could go either way.
All right, so here's what you're going to do. Not that.
Fine. There. Introduce yourself, please.
There you go. My name's Dave White. Also, I am a film critic just like you. Formerly of other places. Now, on hiatus from linoleum-knife.com.
You used to write for so many other websites, and now you're not writing for ours.
Yes, it's because I'm working on...
There's a difference.
I'm working on a book.
Yes.
And yeah. I promise I'm coming back to you all soon with movie reviews in writing. Until then, you get movie reviews right here on this super podcast.
That's right.
And sometimes super. On the radio.
True.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, last week we were on Press Play with Madeline Brand.
Yeah,
if you missed that one, it is available at kcrw.com. You can dig
you
out.
You can find us.
Yeah, it's very simple to find.
Yeah. I know you're excited. You're excited about a thing. hence your...
My up energy.
You're bowling me over with your... you're knocking me off my chair.
Uh-huh. Okay, this sounds... stupid. I grant you this from the beginning. But it's a...
Husband of 20 years.
Yes.
Nothing sounds stupid.
No. Aren't you sweet?
I mean...
Everything sounds stupid.
It sounds unimportant, but, but never stupid.
Now, I mean, I'm not like a hardcore geek, although even geek doesn't have any meaning anymore.
No.
I'm not one of those slavering... like superhero movie fans that's super excited about Marvel's announcement of the next 3 years worth of movies.
You are not that.
I'm not that guy.
I'm very happy that you are not that. I've, as I just mentioned, 20 years.
Yes.
That was this week.
Yes.
We had our 20 year anniversary
this
week.
It's true. 2 decades of this.
Like, we've been federally officially recognized as married since June of this year.
Mm-hmm.
We've been California married since June of 2008.
Correct.
We've been fake married since 1997.
Mm-hmm.
In July, when there was an actual event
right.
that we had. And then, but we have been together a couple,
mm-hmm.
20 years as of October 1st.
That's right.
And in all that time, I have learned many things about comic books. For example, what kind of comic books you like,
mm-hmm.
and what kind of comic books you don't care about. And I have also attended many Comic Cons with you. Those used to be fun.
Yes.
They're not fun anymore.
Well, you're talking about the big Comic Con is not fun.
I'm talking
anymore.
About San Diego Comic Con, yeah. the OG Comic Con.
International, yeah.
The one that used to be fun to go to.
The smaller ones are still okay.
Not fun anymore.
They're manageable.
Anyway, I've learned all these things. You've got how many shelves? 1, 2, 3 long shelves
mm-hmm.
of graphic novels, anthologies.
Well, it's a mix. Some of those are newspaper comics.
Big issues. Some of them are newspaper comics. Some of them are things like Roz Chast.
Right.
Everything, you know, everything. You've got the superhero women book.
Yes.
Which apparently is coveted and prized.
Really?
Many. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
That and the fitness book.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, those two books, people talk about them on the internet, and they're like, oh, yeah, I have that. And they get very sort of, you know,
prideful.
Chest puffy.
Well, I have them both.
About it, yeah. You've been really great about not bugging me too much with it. Unlike me, where, like, my obsession with stuff like contemporary art spills over into there actually being art on our walls.
Right.
That you have to look at every day.
Every day.
Like whether you like it or not.
Uh-huh.
These comic book things, like your actual comic books, are stored in one of the hall closets in a lot of comic book sized boxes. And then the rest of the stuff is out here, but it's just books. It's just, you take one out, you look at it, you put it back, and you don't go, blah, la la la, look at this all day long. You don't put it on the wall and make me look at it. So I've gotten off easier than
pretty
you.
Pretty much, that's true. I'm the better husband. I win.
Okay. I think that's,
Oh, it's not fun if you give up that easy.
What are you excited about?
Okay, so
the thing.
Here's the thing. I grew up reading superhero comics. I've always had an affection for superhero comics, but I've always kind of liked the odd marginalia. You know, I like the issues where suddenly, you know, a giant intergalactic battle has just taken place, and a giant intergalactic battle is about to take place. But this issue, we're just going to sit in a diner and talk. You know, I love issues like that. I love when Marvel does stuff like Assistant Editors Month, and they do bizarre things like make the Avengers go on David Letterman, or team up Aunt May with Franklin Richards and have them fight Galactus.
When you were on The Sewers of Paris, did you talk about that element of your comic book?
We didn't really talk about comics at all.
You didn't.
There's nothing gay about my comics interest. It's just my things that
true.
I'm into.
And that's what that show
that's what
is.
That show's about. Anyway, a thing that I have always championed, and you know, on the internet, whenever it comes up, where somebody will say, you know, what comic book that no one's adapted yet would you like to see made into a film or TV show, or you know, what's an area of the Marvel Universe you think that needs to be explored? Blah blah blah. For years and years, my answer has always been, damage control would make a great workplace comedy.
And the minute you do that, I stare into space and I sip my tea.
Let me explain damage control for people who don't know. The premise of damage control is that in the Marvel Universe, when there's been a giant battle in downtown New York and skyscrapers have been toppled over and intergalactic weapons are lying in the street.
Yes.
Somebody's got to clean that up.
Right.
Somebody has to come in and fix the city and put away the weapons and basically just like be in charge of getting things back to normal. Because the Avengers aren't sticking around to clean up. Spider-Man is not gonna, you know, grab a broom after this stuff. They're off to bigger and better things. Damage control are the ones who actually come in and repair stuff.
You know what?
What?
So they're the people, they're the janitors, and they're the people who take care of details and
they're the you of the Marvel Universe.
I was just, this just became relevant
to
me.
You found this really appealing. I could see you perking up. And so there have been a couple of limited run series, and they've popped up occasionally in other comic books. And like, there's an entire issue that's devoted to trying to get Dr. Doom to pay his back bills. And the cover of the comic book has like Doom's face sort of looming above it, and this guy, an accountant at Damage Control, holding up a past due bill, and it says, "Doom, you'll pay for this." And then the headline at the bottom is, "When Doom defaults."
So, it's stupid.
It is, but I like the idea of realism in a fantastic setting.
When you were
the mundane amidst the, you know, larger than life.
Was this all when you were a kid? Does that appeal to you even as a child?
Well, Damage Control didn't come around until I was like at least in college. But
I see.
But yeah, I always did like the sort of odd issues where superheroes just kind of did regular stuff. You know,
so you've always been a comic book person, but who also sort of stood outside and looked at it and said, here's the weird thing that I think is even funnier than this.
Kind of. Yeah, that's always been an appealing thing to me. So anyway, right before we started recording the podcast today, I get the news from the Wrap.
Because this has nothing to do with film.
No.
Right. Yeah.
That this guy named Ben Carlin, who was a producer on both The Daily Show and The Colbert Report, is going to be producing an ABC series of Damage Control, a half-hour sitcom, the first Marvel Studios sitcom, and it's going to be about Damage Control. And I am so thrilled. I mean, part of me thinks, okay, great. Now, this thing that I've always wanted, which I never thought I was going to get,
now I'm getting it, and
now it's going to be disappointing.
Just like the way you were like, wouldn't it be great if all these comic books were movies?
Yeah. Exactly. Be careful what you wish for, kids. Anyway, so I'm very excited about Damage Control being a TV show. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. And it's weird when you throw stuff out into the universe and every so often one of them comes back and says, okay, yes, you can have that.
You know what I'm very excited about?
What are you very excited about?
Freeheld, the lesbian cancer drama that I just saw. I'm kidding. I'm not excited about it at all.
Let's just
dive in.
Sure.
We have movies to talk about.
Yes.
Freeheld and The Walk and The Martian.
Yeah.
And something you watched.
Christmas Horror Story.
A Christmas Horror Story.
Yeah.
Horror. Yeah.
Well, actually, it's a Canadian film, so we should say horror.
Why don't you talk about the Christmas Horror Story first? Because I could tell. I walked in from Freeheld just now. I went this morning.
Mm-hmm.
Those morning screenings are so good.
Because there's
just no one there. Although, I tweeted about this.
Mm-hmm.
Follow me on Twitter, won't you? At D. Leland White. Leland, that's my middle name. I really wish that movie theaters that have early morning screenings of films.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I don't know what it's like where y'all live, but in Los Angeles, you can go see a movie at like 8 o'clock in the morning sometimes, depending on the screening, depending on the release,
sure.
You know, the theater. If it's a big movie,
or if it's like a kid's movie,
they'll start those screenings really early at breakfast. And so, there are screenings of Freeheld starring
Julianne Moore
and Ellen Page, mm-hmm. 9 o'clock this morning, and I just wish they had breakfast foods at the concession stand. Like, you walk in to the Arclight, and you've got that little cafe.
Sure.
Off to the side. It's not even a cafe. It's the sad remains of what they thought was going to be a bookstore.
Right.
That is no longer a bookstore. But now they have a little...
coffee and tea.
Coffee and tea bar where you can get a cookie
mm-hmm.
that is not very good
mm-hmm.
or a muffin. The muffins are all right.
All right. But no, like, breakfast burrito.
But, no breakfast burrito. Like, wouldn't it be great if you could go? I said on Twitter that I just wanted a big bowl of Lucky Charms while I was watching Freeheld. I think that would just be terrific. And so, wouldn't it be great? And I don't need a big bowl of Lucky Charms. Like, wouldn't it be great if they just had, like, the little bowl, individual bowls?
Oh, like in cafeterias?
Yeah, like with a little container, but like just each Lucky Charms while you're watching them.
I'm just thinking of the people sitting near you having to listen to your...
That's why you go at 9 o'clock in the morning, because there's only three other people in the theater.
Maybe like a cereal that gets soggy really fast.
People eat those gross nachos in theaters and pickles and things that stink and crunchy.
True.
Ain't nobody going to have a problem with me and some soggy Lucky Charms.
Popcorn's not quiet.
Popcorn's not quiet either. So, movie theaters, hear my cry. If you're going to have
early morning shows,
early morning shows, I'd like a bowl of cereal.
And it's not like people would have to try and wrestle down one of those old Kel bowl packs in the dark. You
right.
know,
they're all those, like, they're those plastic bowls so, now.
Yeah, now yeah. they just got a lid. You just yank it right off and you're
although
in business.
I do miss the Kel bowl pack because back in the day when we were little kids, and those were an adventure in eating because you had to cut open the box.
And then you had to cut the bag enough
you had to peel it back.
A bowl, but yeah. not so much that the milk would spill out into the box.
You had to
yeah.
cut the bag open a little bit, but not too much. And then it was fantastic.
Who in the Kellogg's lab thought that anybody was going to get that right?
I got it right every time. I was a very precise child.
Well, you probably had like calipers and a, you know, a compass.
Okay, so we'll get to Freeheld in a minute.
Okay,
tell me
a Christmas
about
horror story.
American Christmas.
No American. Just horror, it's not. It's Canadian.
A Carol for Another no. Horror.
A Christmas Horror Story.
I didn't see it. And when I came home from Freeheld, this was
yeah, this
the
is where you were going. Yeah,
I was going there.
Ages ago.
I took one look at the TV, because mm-hmm. you were watching it on a screener.
Yeah.
And I knew from the production values that I had no interest in watching this film.
Yeah.
It looks like Kirk Cameron's Saving Christmas.
Oh, no. It's a notch or two above that.
Okay,
let's be fair.
All right. I didn't see it.
No, there's at least a little something going on here. There are four kind of intertwined vignettes, and they're all sort of shepherded, if you will, by William Shatner as a DJ who is working on Christmas Eve. So there's one story about these high schoolers who have broken into their high school to investigate a murder that took place there the previous Christmas Eve. There's a story about an awful rich family who accidentally incurs the wrath of the Krampus.
The Krampus is trending.
Krampus is hot, hot, hot. You know, the last couple of years, like, you know, you've had your sort of like your young quote unquote hipster types embracing the Krampus with the, you know, Krampus sweaters and whatnot. And now we have
the Krampus is great. He's a monster.
Absolutely. Yeah. I really had never heard of Krampus until the Venture Brothers Christmas special.
Yeah, until about 10 years ago.
Yeah. Or whenever that was. But
always needed a good Christmas monster.
We've got Krampus coming out in December, by the way, when I went to see the movie that I went to see last night, in another theater, the same company, the same distributor was showing Krampus.
What did you see last night?
I saw Steve Jobs last night. We'll talk about that next week.
That opens next.
Next week. We'll talk about it next week. Yeah, but anyway, they were also showing Krampus at and I told the people at the table, I said, are y'all showing Krampus tonight? And they said, yeah, it's the first test screening. I said, it was like these two gals from the studio who were super nice. And they were actually like, we could probably get you into it, but then you wouldn't see this one. I know, I have to see this one. Duh, dang it. So, you know.
Right.
I'll see Krampus when I see Krampus.
When are they going to show it to us?
It's not opening.
I'm kind of stoked.
I'm very stoked. The trailer is terrific, and our friend Bill Neal cut it. It's coming out, I think, in early December.
He's listening. Hello, Bill.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, yeah. Hi, Bill. So anyway, it's looking forward to that. Anyways, okay, so there's four stories in Christmas Horror Story. The high schoolers, the awful rich family. There's a family that goes into the woods to get a Christmas tree and comes across something diabolical. And then Santa at the North Pole dealing with an outbreak of some sort of zombie virus among the elves.
Okay.
It's mostly kind of lame. It's not really scary. There are two of the four stories have a pretty good twist ending.
Right.
One of them is just whatever, and one of them is kind of almost offensive. Because it's this weird sort of, you could read it as kind of an anti-abortion parable that ties into the virgin birth of Christ. It's just like, oh, shut up. So I wasn't crazy about that one. I will give this movie points for this. Very colorblind casting in that, like, one of the high schoolers is Asian, and the family that goes into the forest to get a tree is black, and nothing is made of it. Like, they didn't cast ethnically because of X, Y, or Z, or because it was somehow, there was some specific thing in the story. They just were, and there they are, and no one comments on it, and, you know, they're just part of the story. And so,
Canada.
It's Canada. And the Asian guy was on Degrassi.
Yeah.
So he was the gay football player's place-kicking boyfriend.
It's Canada where they don't have racism.
They probably
is
have
that right,
racism, but
Canadian listeners,
I think they're
y'all don't have racism.
They're
up
cooler
there. Is
about
that
thing, and that, you know, they're very about their, you know, the phrase first persons.
Yeah, it's first persons is the original Canadians,
right?
Like the original Americans,
yes,
that were normally called Indians here. I don't
yes.
know. If
now
it was a different name.
Now I think they've been upgraded to Native Americans at this point.
No, I know.
Although
yes.
now is you were telling me that
upgraded.
You were telling me that Native is now off the list too, or is that wrong? Or is Native as a noun?
I don't know.
It's hard to keep up.
I'm gonna, but we are keeping up.
That the Canadians are I think cooler than Americans about this sort of thing. You're absolutely right. But yeah, Christmas Horror Story, generally speaking, is just meh. And I think the only reason it's opening now is because they probably want to get it on DVD by
right.
Christmas.
Yes, absolutely.
It's, yeah, so it's in a very small.
It's only in one theater in Los Angeles,
yeah,
right? And,
yeah, at the Burbank Town Center.
In the 8 or the 6?
In the 8.
Okay.
But it's also on demand. Like, you can get it on iTunes. You can get it in various places. So if you're really dying to see this movie, it is available out there. But meh, nothing special. But, you know, it's a Christmas movie, so I got to see it.
No, yes, absolutely. You need to cover that. I am glad that you did. I'm
new listeners may not know. I am the author of a guide called "Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas,"
which is, upon first glance, when you see it, a book with a kind of, let's just say it out loud, kind of a janky cover. They did it. Your publisher just gave you that cover. And you didn't complain. You were like, oh, good. This looks great.
Well, this is actually you're looking at the second or third version. I was able to make some tweaks, but overall,
right.
I couldn't really do much with it.
But please do not judge this book by its cover, because it is.
Or any.
It is lovely. A well-written book by noted film critic Alonso Duralde.
No. Isn't that nice of you to say?
It is nice of me to say, but also it's true, because I know things, and I know you, and I proofed that book.
It's true.
And so,
you read every word of it.
I traipsed through this house, vacuuming and dusting and cleaning things during the summer you spent... watching about 200 Christmas movies. That was weird.
Yeah. Yeah, nothing like A Christmas Carol in July,
right.
And then another Christmas Carol in July, and then another, and then another, and then another.
Let's say you're an early person like me, and you go around buying your Christmas gifts
mm-hmm.
early. Maybe you want to buy this book, Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas, for someone you like. Don't do it just yet. We're going to be selling them directly to you, just like we have for the past however many years.
Five.
When it came out in 2010?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We're still hawking this book.
Yes. And you can get it signed by the author.
Not just signed, but it's going to be like, it's people who got their copies, people who bought copies last year and the year before that, it comes with little treats inside.
That's true.
That we hand... a pick, and it's gift wrapped and beribboned, and
it has
all those
personal touch.
All those things, yeah. So the special linoleum knife edition of Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas
is exclusively available from Linoleum
from
Knife.
This, yeah. So just hang tight, get excited right now, in the bibs way,
right.
But then wait, and then be patient.
We are in the final quarter of the year.
We are now.
Now that October has
now
started.
Now that it's October, yeah.
So as far as I'm concerned,
it's Christmas.
Christmas.
Yeah.
Because as you like to point out, Halloween is not Christmas
number
one.
Number one.
And then Thanksgiving is not Christmas number two.
And then
there's Christmas. Jinx.
Okay, so Free Health.
So
I went
Free
to
Health.
See it. There were no Lucky Charms. Some lesbians, though.
Well, sure.
Straight up lesbians, as Precious,
as Precious would say.
And I already knew this story.
Mm-hmm.
It was national news for queer people.
Yeah, I was at the Advocate when all this was going down.
And Detective Laurel Hester was a detective in New
She was
Jersey,
an Ocean County cop.
Ocean County detective, and she had a partner named
Stacy
Stacy
Andre.
something, yeah.
And because it was
Laurel Hester is played by
Julianne Moore.
Julianne Moore. Stacy is played by Ellen Page.
Because it was the early ooze, the best they could do legally was a domestic partnership.
Just like you and me.
Yep.
We had that domestic partnership in California in the early part of the 2000s.
We did indeed. And so they had a house together, and then Laurel got
Got
cancer.
major lung
Yeah.
cancer, like
Big bad news,
stage
stage
four,
four.
the end of it,
Yeah.
yeah.
So she wanted to leave her pension to Stacy so that Stacy could keep the house that they shared together. And because of a legal loophole, the county board of free
Did not have
holders
to
could not have to.
recognize,
And they chose not to
and they chose
for
not to.
varying reasons, whether it being because they were cheap or they were bigots or whatever,
They
depending on.
were jerks.
Yes. And so then they had to fight for things. And
And they did.
these were not the kind of women who considered themselves activists or wanted to make a big public stink about this
Right.
stuff. Certainly Laurel, as presented in the film, was very much kind of like, I'm keeping my head down, my private life is private,
Right.
nobody needs to know my
She was
business.
essentially closeted at work, according to the film,
Yeah.
until Michael Shannon just got it out of her.
Right. Michael Shannon plays her work partner, fellow policeman. And the movie spends more time with him than you would think in a movie that was about a lesbian couple fighting for the pension.
Sure does.
The film is written by Ron Niswonner, the Academy Award-winning author of the Philadelphia screenplay. And you may recall that Philadelphia is structured to where Denzel Washington is the audience surrogate straight guy who. We get to follow as he learns that gay people are okay and that discrimination is a bad thing. And
Although,
in 1993, that totally made sense.
I'd like to give the movie a little more credit than that.
No, okay,
Because
I'm.
he was already there. He just needed to be told that she was a lesbian. He said to her right away when he found out. He was angry that she didn't trust him
Right,
to tell him.
but he still doesn't immediately get on board her fight to have her relationship legally recognized and to
Correct.
have the
He
pension.
needs a little bit of
Yeah. So,
He needs a little education.
right. So he's again, we have this
Yeah.
sort of audience surrogate figure to like
Yeah.
to do all this stuff. And I think in 1993, yes, absolutely you needed that because there had been so few gays in movies and public attitudes were in a much different place than they are now.
Yes.
In 2015, it feels a little timid. It feels a little
But this movie was set
old-fashioned.
in this movie was set a dozen years
No,
ago.
I know, but I'm talking about as if you're telling the story in
Okay,
2015,
that I understand for
to
sure.
make that character so key, as though we needed him to get into the story.
Right.
In my review in the wrap, I kind of grouped together like Roland Emmerich's. I had to have a straight acting hero so that straight audiences would like the movie. And Matt Damon's, actors should have a sense of mystery. And I kind of, with this movie, and I sort of collectively refer to it as the new timidity.
Yeah.
You would think, like, in the year that like marriage equality became the law of the land, that we would now be moving sort of onward and outward and upward. And now suddenly we have this culture where, and again, maybe an age thing, but you have. These leading figures who are either in the community or allies of the community, very concerned about what straight people might think, and
Yeah.
making sure that we're not ruffling any feathers. And it's kind of like, where is this coming from?
Right.
Is it just, is it just like that the rap headline said, Matt Damon isn't homophobic, he's just old?
Well, how old is Matt Damon? In his 40s, right?
Yeah.
Well, we'll get to Matt Damon in a minute.
But he's been in the industry for like 20 years.
Right. The storytelling here is simply very TV movie-esque. It's not imaginative filmmaking. It's not aesthetically ambitious in
Yeah,
any way.
I compared it to Stanley Kramer in both a good and bad
Yeah,
way.
yeah. It's a kind of meat and potatoes sort of
Yeah.
justice story.
It's a social justice movie and a cancer movie.
That you would see on television.
Yeah.
And that they have been making for television about gay people since, like, the 80s, where, you know, now back in the 80s... They were all about AIDS. The TV movies were all about AIDS, or they were about, you know, accept me.
Yeah.
And then as time has moved on, now they have become stories about
custody battles.
Custody battles. We need our rights. We want our pensions. We want our benefits. All that stuff. And so this film would not be out of place if it had simply been made for cable.
Yeah, like at the time that all this was going on, like 2 years later or something. This is the sort of movie that basic cable would have made, and it would have starred, you know, I don't know, Marky Post and somebody
else. Who's terrific?
Yes, no diss on Marky Post, but you know what I mean. It would have the made for TV equivalents of these two major movie stars.
I don't see Marky Post out at my Monday morning farmer's market at the tennis courts, though. Mm. I do see Ellen Page.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
She goes to that farmer's market. Sorry to out you about that, Ellen Page. I don't want you to get hounded.
No.
But I've seen her there like a couple times.
So this is directed by Peter.
She's always wearing a hoodie and sunglasses and stuff like that. But, I mean, you can't miss her, because they even say in this film, when they're insulting her and telling her she can't have a mechanic's job, they go, "You're 4 feet tall." She is 4 feet tall.
She's a wee slip of a girl. She's a
tiny. It's kind of a weird moment to see her sort of making out with Julianne Moore, because I'm like, why is Julianne Moore making out with this 9-year-old child?
They do kind of look like a mother and daughter, but then at the end of the movie, when you get the requisite photos of the real people under the closing credits, like, oh, well, that's what they looked like.
Yeah,
you know, this is actually, I bet the couple came off.
You know? So
it's directed by Peter Sollett, who did Raising Victor Vargas and Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. It's very straightforward.
And this... not as interesting a film as Victor Vargas or Nick and Nora.
Mm.
He, I'm sure, you know, just wanted to work. And this was a good, safe bet.
So I'm curious as to your thoughts regarding Steve Carell.
Allow me to take another sip of my tea.
Steve Carell plays, I think his name is Stephen Goldstein, who's a lawyer with Garden State Equality.
Do we know if Mr. Goldstein is as annoying as he is portrayed in this film?
I don't know, but I will give the movie credit for this. You have this film that is a rather sedate, kind of not whispery drama, but very low key you know, and one of the things actually
it's as chill as an urgent benefits drama can be.
Yeah. One of the things that I like about it is that I think for a lot of filmmakers, they would be tempted to be more condescending about the sort of working class dreams of these characters. You know, they just want a house and a dog. Like, it's nothing, no big deal. They're not, you know, cosmopolitan at all.
There
and
is
the movie's
no
very respectful.
Yeah, there's no condescension about that at all. Yeah. And that, I did really appreciate that.
So you have these characters who are, you know, would just very happily go through life without anybody knowing that they're gay. They're not marching anybody's parade. They're not making a big deal about it at all. But now they have this crisis, this rights thing where they're being discriminated against. In comes Steve Carell as
super
this,
gay,
as this flamboyant Jewish lawyer, and I say Jewish because he wears a yarmulke in every scene. That is actually it's a
lavender yarmulke
that says Garden State Equality. Stitched into it. And at first I thought, oh my god, like he came in from another movie. But then I thought, but he did come in from another movie. That's the whole point.
Yeah.
That for these women, this guy would seem like he was from another universe entirely. But these universes exist side by side. You have these kind of small town, you know, off the radar gays who just don't want to be messed with and would rather, you know, slip into the woodwork. And then you have like pot stirrers like this guy who's like, no, we're going to take this fight to the Supreme Court, you know,
and calling all the guys honey and stuff like
and there's
that.
Room for both of them, you know, and I enjoy both of them. And he's supposed to be jarring is what I'm saying. I think the movie gets that right. Actually,
I got used to him after a few moments. And this has nothing to do with any discomfort that I happen to personally have about
loud volume,
loud feminine gay men. Lord knows, got a lot of them in my life. That is not a situation that I have a problem with. If I have any problems at all, it's initial discomfort with heterosexual actors.
Ah, well, there is that, yeah.
Doing the gay accent. You know? Walking on screen and going, yes, girl. You know, like, that is, to me, leaning into
minstrelsy.
Yes. And I got used to it with him, and I decided that this guy, this real life guy, must be this guy.
Well, exactly. I figured that this is probably how he is, and that this guy does this.
And that's great.
That is part of his way of rattling his opponents.
Yes.
You know, because, and that's a very lawyery thing, you know, that you do something that just makes the other person snap. And so he's dealing with these sort of stuffed shirt, like Christian bigot types on the board of Freeheld and stuff. And that he knows exactly who his quarry is and that he's going to rattle them.
There's nothing better than an angry queen in the face of
causing discomforts,
making awful straight people upset.
Yes.
That's the best thing in the world. I wish the film Stonewall had effectively portrayed that.
Indeed.
My sole issue is, who is this straight actor and why is he doing this particular thing on screen right now?
Right.
Is it because he thinks that's what a gay person does? Or because this real life person is this way? And I decided, without ever having seen or heard
Stephen Goldstein,
this guy, that because Steve Carell has already played gay,
I was just going to say, in Little Miss Sunshine,
in a completely different way,
yes,
that I was going to give him the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, like, this is the antithesis of the Little Miss Sunshine character, who was literally suicidal.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think Carell knows better, and so, you know, I think I gave him the benefit of the doubt too. But yeah, I'm sure, like,
Steve Carell eats the screen every time he's on.
Yes. If they had cast Matt Bomer, you wouldn't have to have that moment of because
correct.
Yeah.
Correct. Yeah.
So I'd say it's worth seeing, but yeah, it is very much kind of a, as you say, it's a meat and potatoes issue movie.
I liked Julianne Moore and Ellen Page.
I thought they
were very sweet together.
I liked their courtship, where, like, they have this falling out, and then Julianne Moore calls her up and says, was it basically, I think you're terrific or something?
I think you're great, and I'm a jerk.
She kind of barks it out, which is great. And we have to mention Julianne Moore's hair in this movie.
Sucks.
It's almost a character unto itself, because at the beginning of the film, she has this, like, super crispy sprayed Farrah Fawcett hairdo. Like, there are several scenes where she's in another room and you just hear the or the hairdryer. And then as she softens in her relationship with the Ellen Page character, so does the hair. And then, of course, she gets cancer, so they have to shave it all off.
Right.
So it's like the hair has its own arc in this film.
It's fine.
It's
fine. I saw The Martian.
Yeah.
Last night. All right. Here's how good The Martian is. I forgot about every annoying, horrible thing that happened to me before seeing The Martian.
You had quite the evening.
Here are the horrible things that happened to me before seeing The Martian. I was driving on DeLong Prairie, which is my super secret back way to get to the ArcLight.
It's a two-lane street.
It's a residential street.
There's cars parked on both sides. It goes all the way through.
If you live in Los Angeles and you want a secret, you know, shortcut kind of route to go
between, like, La Brea and Vine,
Betty Davis's old advice of take Fountain is no longer applicable. because that was 100 years ago when she said that. Now, take De Longpré, if you're up there. It's between Fountain and Sunset. And apparently there was another short cutter. They were behind me.
It was in a hopped up hurry.
Real hopped up hurry. We don't know where. Initially, I did not know where they were going or who this person was. They were driving an Audi. And at one point in my drive, they pulled out from behind me, drove into the oncoming lane with cars coming at them, and then zoomed it back into the lane, cutting me off. Now, that's annoying, but it's not the end of the world because people are jerks and they do that all the time here. But it got this person nowhere because there were cars in front of me too. There just happened to be enough space for them to pull out into the oncoming traffic, endanger all kinds of people, and then pull back.
It's not like you were the little old lady from Pasadena who was single-handedly tying up the street.
No, exactly. There was a lot of folks on this driving. And each time we came to a stop sign, whoever was in front of this car, which was now directly in front of me, would take their turn, and this person would take their turn at exactly the same time. Meanwhile, there are cars waiting at every other stop sign.
So they would double dip.
They would double dip on the turn, inconveniencing rudely everyone else that was waiting their turn. This happened twice. In the course of this half-mile stretch of road, they laid on their horn so much. Like, everyone had to get out of their way.
Like, lady with a baby here.
Yeah. Like, I thought, oh, they're on their way to the emergency room. Someone's dying. That's has to be what's happening. So we get to Ivar, which is the street right bordering the Arc Light and the... And De Longpré.
Yeah.
And they take that double dip turn again. Only this time they turn left, which is also what I have to do, so I can get into the Arclight parking lot. And I wait my turn, but I'm keeping my eye on them. They turn into the Arclight parking lot. And I thought, oh, good. I'm going to find out who this is. Suddenly, I became very excited. So I waited my turn. I took my left. I drove into the Arclight parking lot. I'm getting my ticket. I see them going up the ramp. I'm like, I'm going to follow you wherever you park. I'm going to follow you. So I do. I follow them to our spot. I have also made the decision that if it is a terrifying looking person who may or may not have a weapon, I'm going to let them do their business. Not going to make trouble. But these were old people. These were old people not going to pose me any threat. And so,
face your wrath.
That's right. An older man and an older woman. And the woman was driving. They get out of their car. I get out of mine. I park right next to them. Mm. I get out of mine and I say, you are the worst driver in the world. You run through stop signs. You double dip on the stop signs. You drove into oncoming traffic. You're honking at people. I thought you had some kind of emergency. You're just late for a movie. You are horrible. Everything you did was wrong and illegal. The guy says nothing. They're walking. Mm. They're walking pretty fast away from
me. Yeah, imagine.
But the woman is giving me sass. She's like, I don't want to hear it.
She's giving you, like, waving you
waving
off.
My hand, waving her hand at me. And I was like, you suck. Then I got in my car and I drove up to the roof where I always drive.
Right.
Mostly because I always park on the roof. So I can see beautiful Los Angeles all around me when I get up to the roof. And also because I didn't want her, like,
key your car.
Slashing my car. Well, keying my car wouldn't make much difference.
That's true, your car.
But I didn't want her cutting my tires or anything because she's treacherous. And I knew you don't know what's in that purse. There was probably a knife.
That's true. She could have maced you. You're lucky.
But I was about 20 feet away.
Oh, okay.
And I wasn't approaching. I stood outside my car and I stood still and yelled and waved my arms.
Oh, so you didn't follow them?
No. Because I didn't want to seem like I was aggressively approaching, like I was going to harm them or something, which I had no intention to do. I just wanted to scold them and tell them how they were very, 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 very wrong and bad, and that they should feel bad.
Well, mission accomplished.
They don't feel bad.
No, they don't.
They don't feel bad at all.
They're entitled,
boy,
terrible people.
I'll tell you what did feel me. I felt great when it was over.
And then
I went to the Cinerama Dome, all keyed up with justice, and it's like 95 degrees in the lobby.
And it wasn't because of your elevated blood pressure.
No. Although that was, I'm sure it was a little bit of a factor, but it was super hot in the Cinerama Dome. And I thought, oh no! This is not going to be one of those nights where every single thing is wrong. I walk in there, I go up to the concession, I need a bottle of water. I buy a bottle of water, and I look at the concession boy, and I go, is the extreme temperature of this lobby indicative of what's going to be happening inside the theater? And he goes, not really. And you know how I love those sort of equivocating answers. I said, not really? He goes, it should be okay. I said, so you don't actually know? He goes, I don't really know. He goes, but it is kind of hot back here because of the popcorn machine and stuff. I said, popcorn machines do not heat up entire film theater lobbies. They simply do not. Especially in a theater as huge as the Cinerama Dome.
No.
Okay. I go into the theater. I'm about the first person in. And it's stifling hot in there. Mm. And I walk up to the usher guy who's in the theater, and I go, when's the air conditioning coming on? He goes, oh, you're right, it is a little stuffy in here. I go, it's more than a little stuffy. It's brutally hot in here.
Were there no afternoon shows? Were you like, this is the first show of the day?
I don't know what the story was. Mm. The guy gets his walkie-talkie, and he goes, can we look into the AC? It's a little stuffy in here. And I go, a lot stuffy.
Give me that walkie-talkie. I'm dying.
They turn on the air. Within about 10 minutes, it started to cool down. Like, they have a fairly sturdy air conditioning system in there. If it can, I mean, that's an enormous space.
It's a big room.
And I thought, oh, no, they'll turn on that air now, and it won't get hot. It won't get cool until, like, 2 hours from now because this place is so big. But, no, it started to cool down. I sit down in my seat, and you know I hate being near people. Mm. I just don't like being near people at all. And this big old lummox, my size kind of dude, wearing a hat, sits down right in front of me. And I just, okay, well, I'm going to move. When the trailers begin and most of the folks are in, I'm going to move. Now, when you're in the dome, the seats in the back, on the sides, nobody ever sits there. Nobody wants to sit in those seats. But I don't care. So the trailer starts, I move over there. After the first trailer, in comes this couple. They stand, they walk right up to me. And I go, am I really in your seat? And they're like, uh-huh. And I was like, all right, I'll go. And that giant dude in the hat sat in front of me. I moved down about 6 rows. I'm alone in the row. After the next trailer, some dude comes in, sits about 5 seats away from me in the row. That's about the minimum amount of space I want between me and another human being. He takes out his phone and begins to do phone things. I think, all right, you get it through the trailer. You can do this in the trailers. Don't make me regulate. I've already had a full evening of this already. Nothing matters
You've
anymore.
You've been drinking green tea all day.
I'm all hopped up. Yeah. He checks his texts about 15 minutes into the film.
Ugh.
And I thought, I will kill him. Today is the last day of our acquaintance. But I let it go. Because I'm like, I at this point, I was really trying to watch the movie, and I didn't want to have to.
Yeah.
I just didn't want to anymore.
And,
like,
and you're freewheeling.
I didn't want to. No, I'm not. That was a bit.
Thank you.
It was a bit I was doing a long time ago. By the way, in case anyone was curious.
Not in the slightest freewheeling, yes.
Then he uses his phone again.
And
I got up, and I said, F your phone. And then I went down to the floor area, and I sat off by myself. And then it was fine for the rest of the movie.
Okay.
But boy howdy, it was a reminder to me that to live in Los Angeles is to encounter really wonderful people most of the time and extremely horrible people also most of the time.
Well,
and so you have to decide who you're going to pay attention to. Who gets your energy? Because I know and experience all kinds of great folks every day. But I also know, or I don't know them because they're not my friends, but I experience the awfulest human beings on the planet also every day. And when you get them in a row, bang, 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 like all through, or circumstances that suck.
Sure.
Like no AC, which is pretty much you're asking me to go into a rage.
Well, in the movie,
then I want to start harming.
In the movie Insignificance, the Native American elevator operator tells Albert Einstein about the belief that wherever you are is the center of the universe.
Yes,
and I think people in Los Angeles sort of take that in all the wrong ways.
So yeah, instead of causing another scene, I just got up and moved. Like a hero.
And apart from that, Mrs. Lincoln, how did you enjoy the theater?
Yeah, I like this movie a lot, The Martian.
I did, too.
Matt Damon is a Martian, and he's on Mars, and he doesn't want to live on Mars anymore. So he contacts Earth, and he says, hey, I'm a real friendly Martian. Y'all come get me. I look like Matt Damon. So I'll be a benefit to Earth. Kind of cute.
Yeah, that's not at all what happens.
Is that not what happens?
I think people know.
Was I watching
Matt
the
Damon,
movie with my own filter?
I think so, yes.
Okay.
Matt Damon plays an astronaut who gets left behind on Mars when there's like a storm that knocks out the communications in his suit, and they can't see him, and they assume that he has died, and he has not. And so he's got to figure out, how do I survive with the temporary lodgings and the limited amounts of food and water and oxygen that I have without dying until somebody can either come get me or another Mars expedition lands. And it's pretty much this kind of series of problems that all the science-y people solve one at a time.
Yes.
And I was really excited by a movie that was all about smart people who are good at their jobs fixing a desperate situation, you know? And it wasn't, fixing the desperate situation wasn't about beating each other up or blowing stuff up or, you know, Batman. You know, it was smart people who were good at their jobs, and it was exciting.
I've been resistant to this film because of Gravity.
Mm.
I've seen Gravity.
Yeah.
I think Gravity is terrific. And I didn't really feel the need to see Boy Gravity.
This is more a cross between Apollo 13 and Castaway.
That is correct. You're right. And so walking into the film, I thought, okay, you know, show me what you got. It has nothing to do with the style or tone of Gravity.
No,
not at all. The similarities end with a person trapped in space.
Yeah. It's quite funny, too.
It is funny. He's a pretty chill bro for a man who's stuck 50 million miles from Earth.
Right.
He's a little perky, a little jaunty, in a way that, personally, I can't understand.
Well, I think whereas you get the impression that Sandra Bullock's astronaut got like the minimum amount of NASA training.
Yes.
This guy seems like he maybe went through like full course.
Yeah. What it really feels like to me is that Sandra Bullock's character reacted like a person who was about to die. And Matt Damon reacted like a person who can see the craft services table.
Out the corner of his eye.
Out of the corner of his eye. Which, you know, that's the way the character is written. Mm-hmm. Fine. He's got wisecracks to make to no one.
Well, he's keeping a log, a video log, yes. Which is a way for him to talk to somebody and
keep
and
his sanity.
Tell the audience what's going on.
Right.
Know?
As
Bibbs likes to say regarding Doctor Who and the current companion, what is your function apart being somebody that people can explain things to?
He explains everything to us by making this video log.
Yeah.
And honestly, his perkiness is not a problem for me. As I watched it, I thought, I would just take my helmet off.
Yeah, you'd go fetal
and die. Yeah, like I would just let it happen because the panic would never stop. If and that were me, mm-hmm. as an astronaut.
Yeah, as an astronaut is already not computing it in the slightest.
It would be like a Jerry Lewis movie, like like the fatstronaut, you know,
well,
like,
way out was a Jerry Lewis.
That's what I'm saying.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it'd be like way out, but the plot would be, check out this fat astronaut. He's going to die.
You're more like Chuck McCann in Far Out Space Nuts. But I'm not Bob Denver.
So, here's what I appreciate about this film the most. I love Ridley Scott's anything goes approach to space.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a monster chasing you, or whatever the hell was happening in Prometheus, which I fully support still to this day.
You're one of the few people I know that supports The Counselor, which I still haven't seen.
The Counselor is not set in outer space, but it is set on what might be another planet. And it is a fantastic film. And if you don't like it, we're probably not friends. So
that cuts you off from a lot of people.
I don't care. I don't need anyone. Except you and that big jar of Nutella on the counter that I'm looking at right now with fondness.
That I brought you from Italy.
In my mouth. This one is set in a moment in history which might be the future, sort of.
Well,
it might be the present where we have a Mars program.
Yeah, it's sort
with
of like
NASA.
It's a present where like NASA never stopped. You know,
right.
You get this feeling after a while that NASA kind of didn't really do anything. But if NASA had been funded and people were enthusiastic about space and had kept going, maybe today would be like this.
It's set in the United States where people are genuinely enthusiastic about the space program.
Right.
A contemporary world where science is not anyone's enemy.
Right.
Currently we have a bizarre amount of anti-intellectual feeling in this country and distrust of science among the stupidest of our population and among the most cynically opportunistic
right.
members of our government.
Yeah.
So in this film, what you have is a world where science is allowed to be science and where science solves problems and people are encouraged to collaborate and cooperate internationally mm-hmm. and where the future doesn't look grim and horrifying. It looks like a place where things could actually be better.
Yeah, this is the movie that Tomorrowland wanted to be in a lot of ways.
And that is why I believe the movie is actually about climate change, because what we are really doing to our own planet right now mm-hmm. is turning it into a hostile environment.
Mm.
And we have to figure out ways
to solve the problem,
to adapt to it in a way that allows human beings to continue functioning
mm-hmm.
and which also preserves the planet
yeah.
from killing us.
Yeah, I love this movie just in the way that it tells its story and that it's compelling and it's suspenseful, because you don't, you know, you may think you know how it ends, but you don't know how it's going to get there. It's funny and it's smart and it's sharp and all that stuff. But at the same time, I can't remember the last time that I saw a movie that rekindled all those sort of kid feelings of, you know, when we were kids, everybody wanted to be an astronaut.
Right.
No one talks about that anymore. Like, it's
right.
Because people are like, what's an astronaut? You know, or
I wanted to be Godzilla.
Well, sure. I don't know that I ever wanted to be an astronaut per se, but I just
I never
knew
cared
that
about
it was
being
a,
an astronaut.
It was a thing. It was an option, you know. And so yeah, this movie just makes it makes knowing things seem like a great thing, you know, like that being smart might actually save your life,
right?
And that, you know, book learning does not make you a jerk.
Did I ever tell you about the time when my uncle said that to me?
Oh boy, what? This is one of those Christmas home visits?
Kind
of,
yeah. It was like, sure got a lot of book learning, don't you?
Oh, brother.
Like, literally, my uncle said that to me once. And I said, yeah, because I read books. Like, I was in high school, I think.
That's how it works.
And he goes, well, there's book learning and then there's common sense. He goes, I don't know how much common sense you have. I said, is there a book about it? Like, I'll figure that out. I'll find the common sense book and read it.
And heaven knows your family was steeped in common sense at every turn.
So, the science in this movie,
mm-hmm.
who knows if it's good or bad or real or not? Here's what I want to do. I want to get my buddy, Bob, that I went to Texas Tech with. I want Bob Nolte. I don't think he listens to the show, but I really wish that I had the presence of mind last night to be all like, all right, come over tomorrow afternoon, because you need to be on our podcast and tell us if the science works. I'm going to message him.
I'm sure there will be plenty of articles this weekend.
There probably will. Neil deGrasse Tyson is going to go see this movie and like have a whole laundry list of what's wrong. Yeah. But
our critic friend Giovanna, who writes about movies and science, is a fan. I know she loved this movie.
I don't even care if the science doesn't pan out, because
it's plausible.
I think of the film as aspirationally scientific, you know, where
if we're not there yet,
maybe we could get there.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe this thing that can't happen right now
could.
Maybe we'll figure out a way to make it happen.
Yeah,
if we will only just stop being idiots.
Mm-hmm.
And not make ourselves
extinct.
And return science back to its rightful place of being the thing that everyone looks to and respects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, Miss Damon.
Girl.
Oh, her.
She's a mess.
Here's my thing. Celebrities need to go to question answering school. Here's why. I've said this before on the show. If you're a famous person, you need someone who tweets for you.
Mm-hmm.
You stay away from Twitter.
Yeah.
Hire someone who knows enough to tell you that you're not smart enough to be on Twitter.
Exactly.
Hire someone who knows you well enough to tell you that you had not to be opening your mouth.
If you want to tweet something, you would then text it to that person and they would vet it.
Yeah. Obviously, you can't ask the journalist for their questions first.
Right.
But you can have an SAT coach or something who will help you figure out, like, okay, when directors from other countries come to town for Q&As or interviews, they have translators.
Right.
Why don't you just have a dumbness translator that you hire? Like, you know yourself well enough to be all like, you know what? I just don't know things. I just don't know things. I'm going to hire someone who knows things. And when I'm asked a question, I'm going to lean in and I'm going to say, and the person's going to go, okay, okay. Got it. And then you're going to say, I really feel that as a straight actor, I don't have enough experience with this issue to fully understand what it's like to be a gay actor. And so I don't know the answer to that question. And I
It's not
think,
really my place to
and
say.
it's not my place to say, and I think that we should listen to the stories of queer actors who have things to say about their treatment in this industry. There's your answer, Matt Damon.
And then here's a tip. Don't then go on Ellen and claim that you were taken out of context
Right.
or misunderstood
Oh,
or
those
that they lied
quotes.
about it and they
Why so
twisted.
much quoting?
And then say the same thing again.
So I think Matt Damon is a good guy. He just doesn't know the answer to this question and doesn't know that he's not supposed to say stuff
Yeah.
yet.
Also, don't
I think he
lecture Effie
knows now.
Brown about
And
diversity while you're at
this
it.
is the worst thing, okay? I think his dumbness about race in the entertainment industry is worse than his dumbness about gay, because he's a producer and a writer, and he knows that world. He
Sure.
knows the world of producing entertainment products. Therefore, he should know more about including all kinds of people in it.
Yes.
That is actually a dumber thing that he did
Yeah.
than the gay
We
comment.
don't hate you, Matt Damon, but shut up. Finally, speaking of things that should shut up, The Walk.
Yeah. You're gonna have to go with it. You're gonna have to talk about this one because I'm full of feelings, and I'm also full of thinks.
Yes,
I have
no,
thinks.
you
I
are.
have
Thinks
thinks,
and
and I have
feels.
feels.
Yes.
So you go.
Okay,
Yeah.
so it's if you saw A Man on Wire, you know the
And I did.
story.
I watched it yesterday.
Oh, good. Okay,
Finally, I
good, good,
watched it
good.
yesterday.
You know the story of Philippe Petit, the French aerialist and wire walker who, in the early 1970s, managed to walk a tightrope between the two towers of the World Trade
He's
Center.
the human Pepe Le Pew. I watched Man on Wire. I watched Man on Wire yesterday, and I can tell you that Joseph Gordon-Levitt's performance of this guy, not so far away from this guy. Like,
Maybe.
not so far from the
But
mark.
sometimes
The
realism
fir
can be problematic. Like
yeah.
when, like in Lorenzo's Oil, when Nick Nolte is doing that like super Giuseppe accent,
Yeah, yeah,
and then
yeah.
you hear the real guy's like, oh wow, you really talk like that. But still, when Nick Nolte does it, it's
It
weird.
seems weird, yeah.
Okay, so yeah, so this is the Robert Zemeckis movie about it because he watched that documentary and thought, you know what? They didn't send the camera out on the wire, and I can fake that. And so, hence, we get this movie.
Right.
And Joseph Gordon-Levitt is Pepe Le Pewing it up with the accent.
In a way that
Is never not distracting.
it was very distracting, because there are actual French speaking actors in this
Yeah,
film.
everyone else in the film who's playing French is at least French Canadian.
And the way they speak English is different than
He speaks French accented
the way
English.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt is speaking French accented English. And it's a bit of a jarring experience to hear him talking to, I'm blanking on her name.
Charlotte Le Bon.
Yeah. And hearing sort of the cadence of her voice and the emphasis on
The
English,
emphasis on the syllables.
yeah, her emphasis on English words is the emphasis a French person would place on the French equivalent of that word,
Right.
and so his it's kind of weird sometimes. Anyway, go on.
So the movie is, in a way, almost kind of like a heist film in that it's about how does he do it? You know, which is also what Man on Wire is about. How do you sneak into the World Trade Center? How do you get that wire across in the first place? You know, how do you prepare for the walk? How do you? And I like this movie more than you did. I mean, the writing is terrible. The conceit of the film is that Petit is sort of narrating this whole thing, standing on the torch of the Statue of Liberty with the towers behind him. And the movie keeps cutting back to him, explaining
And telling
things
you how
that
to
are obvious
feel.
and telling you how you should feel about
Yeah.
things. And, you know, it just sort of underlining everything that's already actually happened and is occurring. And it's really irritating. But when they finally get to The Walk, there were parts of it that I felt were a little Zemeckis Uncanny Valley-ish, where I thought, wow, I'm looking at a video game character
right.
in the middle of this completely artificial space.
Yes.
And then, but that was only a few times. The rest of the time, I was pounding my armrest and going, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. Like, if you have actual fear of heights and you see this movie in 3D IMAX, if you see this movie in 3D IMAX, as you did, it's, you will have panic attacks.
Yes, and I did.
Yes. So, know that going in. But I will say, it's a pretty stunning sequence. And then on top of that, very much to my surprise, found myself bursting into tears on like three or four different moments of the film. There was something about the World Trade Center existing again, you know, being made to seem tangible, you know, in a completely digital creation, that I found really moving. And you know, reminded me, one of the things that happened from the walk is from the actual walk that Petit did, is that it made New Yorkers like those buildings. They had sort of been considered an eyesore before that, and he kind of imbued them with this majesty that made them a source of civic pride. And so I found this film kind of like one of my favorite sort of 9/11 memorials in a way, because 9/11 is never mentioned, it's never brought up specifically, but it's there, it's unavoidable throughout. And, you know, it sort of reminded me that, you know, when you think of someone that you love or a famous person that you admire, if they die horribly, you don't only think of that person in regards to their death. You know, you think about the life they had, and then you also think about the tragedy of how that life ended. And so often when we look at the Trade Center now, when we see photos of it or it's cited somehow in the culture, all we think about is the tragic part. And this movie, I felt like, was a reminder of, no, it actually had a life first, and it existed first, and there were things about it that we came to love about it, and a reason why it stood out in the popular imagination before the tragic demise.
Related to that, I cannot see films about the World Trade Center or 9/11 or that employ those things in any way without feeling unhappy in my stomach.
Hmm.
Whether the film is good or bad, and when I've written reviews about those films, I have tried to keep my own discomfort out of the review. I've tried to look at the film as a film.
Remember Me was terrible no matter what.
Remember Me is a grotesque, exploitive film. Regardless, and it's the worst of them.
Yeah,
it's the nastiest of all of them because it's a twist, it's a reveal, it's a punch in the gut that happens at the end.
Yeah,
and yeah, that's a spoiler, and there's a good reason why it deserves to be spoiled. Mm. Just a rotten movie. But so I can't look at United. Well, I saw United 93, and it sent me round the bend. And I saw World Trade Center, and it's much more, you know, survival and hope and stuff like that. This film never mentions 9/11. It is merely highly suggestive,
right,
of 9/11. It is. It is no coincidence that Philippe Petit's dialogue in the film is never once about death. He's always like, this is not about death or danger, this is about life.
Yeah.
I'm doing this because life is so great, and look at this thing that I can do, this beautiful thing that I can do, and with these two beautiful buildings. But it doesn't help me, because all I think of when I see a shot from a camera pointing down is the destruction of those buildings and people falling out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was deeply unhappy watching this film pretty much from start to finish. And I confess that during the actual walk sequence, which is about the last 20 to 25 minutes of the film, because he stayed on that wire for 45 minutes, walking back and forth, kneeling down, lying down on it, anything he could think to do in a sort of defiant, joyful gesture to the police and to the, you know, the
Onlookers.
onlookers. He did it. I had my eyes closed for most of this because, unlike in Man on Wire, which, you know, is a documentary,
And doesn't really show you the walk itself.
it does show you the walk itself because he had his camera people up there with him. But that camera was not on
On the
the wire
wire,
with him. So this CG stuff that Robert Zemeckis is so invested in puts you right there on the wire. And then the 3D IMAX of it all, it not only puts you on the wire, it allows you the feeling
That
of
perspective.
what if you fell right now a quarter mile to the earth? That is horrifying to me, and it filled me with panic. My palms were sweating. I could not watch it. I opened my eyes every 10 to 15 seconds just to see where the action was taking the film, but I couldn't look at it.
I hyperventilated a little, but I stayed watching.
I got to the point where I was really, really very upset. So it is an incredibly visceral experience if you see it in 3D IMAX. I think even if you don't see it in 3D IMAX, it's only opening this week in 3D IMAX, and then it's
Right,
going
to
to
expand.
expand next week.
But if you're going to see it at all, shell out for the full
I
treatment,
suppose.
you
I
know.
suppose. I don't know. I'm now. Let's just talk about the film itself. I'm not a fan of Robert Zemeckis. I am not a
I
fan of his
haven't been in a
filmmaking.
long time.
His filmmaking style does not agree with me. I am not on board with, you know, everything being a swooping, soaring thrill ride, and that is what this film
He
does.
took
Even before the walk itself, he is booming and zooming the whole way
He
through.
took a turn somewhere, and I'm wondering if it all goes back to Death Becomes Her.
Possibly.
A movie I love, but a movie that was very much about the latest cutting edge
Yeah,
digital
stuff.
trickery,
Right.
and I feel like he's so into the trickery now that that's the guiding impulse and not the storytelling.
Yes.
But yeah, so the movie has a lot of problems, but at the same time, like I said, I cried four times, and that walk is sort of undeniably visceral and terrifying, and it really, if the point of the movie was to
Even though you
recreate,
know he's fine.
yeah, if the point of the movie was to recreate what that event was like for Philippe Petit, I would say it does it rather
Right.
well.
Right. If you want to know about this story and you don't want to be completely freaked out,
See Man on
just
Wire.
watch Man on Wire.
Absolutely.
It's on Netflix right
Yeah.
now. It's streaming. And it's a better film.
Oh, yeah,
Yeah.
undeniably.
Yeah. And I had avoided Man on Wire for all the reasons that you were talking about before. So yeah.
All right. What's your DVD pick this week?
The Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Really?
Yes.
Why?
Well, a new 40th anniversary Blu-ray just came out.
Right.
And it's got all this kind of extra stuff on it.
Yeah.
I mean,
I mean,
if you haven't seen the Rocky Horror Picture Show, it is a film you should see.
yes, you should experience it one time at least.
Either at home or in a theater with all
Well,
the people.
no, you
No,
should. Yeah.
in any, I will say anytime you want to. In whatever circumstances you see it in, you should see it at least once. You should also see it at least once with that
I think
crowd.
you need to see it once with
Yes.
that crowd. Yes,
Yeah.
because I think that experience in and of itself is a thing that everybody should experience once. Yes.
But this Blu-ray has so many extra things
Such
on it.
as
The US and UK versions of the film, a black and white version of the film,
Oh.
you know, documentaries about the midnight experience of the film. Because it's been, I mean,
40 years.
It's been playing for 40 years. It has never stopped being in theaters. There are, you know, commentaries and deleted musical stuff. And, you know, it's just a fun big bag of extra stuff.
Okay.
And I'm not, I was not a huge Rocky Horror
person. I never
person.
Thought of you as being a big fan of
it. I saw it, I think, how many times? In the theater. Two or three times. Nothing major.
Yeah, same here.
Just with friends, you know. Hey, you want to go do this? You know, like, yeah. But as I watched the first chunk of extras, it got me to thinking about Matt Baume's podcast, The Sewers of Paris, that you and I were both on. It's called The Sewers of Paris.
Right.
You were on one episode. I was on another episode. It's a podcast about gay men talking about
the pop culture,
the popular culture that influenced them.
Yeah.
And your episode was mostly about
film and television.
Mine was mostly about music.
Right.
And one of the things I said, the guiding principle of what I was talking about on the show was, punk rock taught me to be disobedient to the oppressive environment that I was living in. And one of the ways in which punk rock taught me to be disobedient was to go see the Rocky Horror Picture Show when I was told that I really was not
allowed
to. Oh, well, yeah.
I'm sure that was a no-no for your church.
Yeah. But it wasn't just my church. My oldest brother, during my teenage years, my oldest brother had sort of been, what's the right word? Given the task of being the parent in the house. And I remember when Rocky Horror finally came to Roswell. For the very first time. At a midnight screening, they were going to do it.
Like 1980-ish?
And everyone was going. Literally everyone in my high school was going. And my brother was like, no. No, this is, you can't. You're not. You're not. I know what this film is, and you're not going. I was like, I am. He's like, no, you're not. And my sense of guilt about disappointing him was so great that I did not go. A year later, however, when he was not the influence in my life, I totally went. But it was still a no-no in terms of like, church. In fact, I went with some church kids, and after the movie, they were all like, "Oh, that was wrong. No, we're bad for going to see that." And I was like, "No, that was kind of rad. Like, that was all right. That was weird and freaky, and I'm glad we did that." You know, but inside, but outside of me, I was like, "Oh yes, yeah, absolutely. Oh yes, by all means. What a terrible thing we've just done." So I have an affection for Rocky Horror.
Sure.
Not because I became addicted to it or part of that little microculture, but just because it's just one more thing from my adolescence that was emblematic of, you know, breaking up with the church.
Ah.
Yeah.
All right.
So, yeah.
Well, my DVD pick this week is Robinson Crusoe on Mars, a 1950s movie about...
I've never seen that.
About an astronaut who has been abandoned on Mars, very much like The Martian. And like The Martian, it really does its best to get the science right. Like, it's really about him trying to figure out how he's going to have enough oxygen and how he's going to, you know, be able to survive. And the Criterion Collection actually put out a very nice Blu-ray of it a couple years ago with a lot of extras, with interviews with the writer and the director, and they actually talk about things they disagreed about during the making of the movie and all. So, yeah, it's worth checking out. It's an interesting movie, very much a precursor to The Martian.
So, what's happening now?
Should we do a couple of letters, and then I need to skedaddle?
Oh, you've got a screening to go to, yeah. Right? Yeah. What's pulling up letters and subject line?
Oh, by the way, big news that dropped this week that we should mention. Drafthouse Films has announced that they will be releasing Dangerous Men before the end of this year. John S. Rad's Dangerous Men, one of the loopiest of the outsider art written, directed, produced by movies. Unlike Tommy Wiseau and others, he did not star in it. But this movie is nutty. It took quite a while to finish, which you can tell because several of the actors in the film visibly age on screen and not in the boyhood way.
Not at all.
It's nuts. And we actually...
It will explode your mind.
Yeah.
It is truly staggering and crazy and wild in the most wonderful, damaged, confusional way. Yeah.
The movie had a 1 week run in Los Angeles, and luckily we had somebody to urge us to go see
Andy.
It. Andy Zaks. Yeah. And we have not regretted it. So, but now more people will get to see it, and that's going to be exciting.
Hi, Alonzo and Dave. This is from Daniel.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the Stonewall review was very interesting. I'm disappointed that the movie seems to be really bad, and am especially disappointed in John Robin Bates, who I thought would actually be a good choice for this material. I'm confused as to why they felt they had to create an almost completely fictional story to hang it on, because the real story is pretty interesting, and the historical figures are pretty compelling in their own right.
Mm-hmm.
There are two really good books, both called Stonewall, one by Martin Duberman, that's the one I know about.
Yeah, which I read a million years ago.
And one by David Carter. It is in these books that I first heard the term scare drag queen or flame queen.
Ah, okay. See, I read Duberman so long ago, I don't remember the details.
I think they must have been terms used mostly in the village or on the East Coast. My take is that they were mostly young street kids who weren't looking to pass as women,
mm-hmm.
but did wear makeup and some items of female clothing, and definitely had a camp sensibility, even though they were pretty tough.
Well, I think at the law of the time said like that a man couldn't wear more than like two or three
something
articles.
Like that.
There was like a count of how many articles of women's clothing you were allowed to wear without it being illegal.
Yeah. In my readings, I think the drag queens in that time would have talked more about passing. I don't remember hearing realness until the 70s or 80s, maybe with Sylvester, but that doesn't mean that's when it came from. I haven't been able to find anything about when it started. There is a lot of argument about who was in the bar at the time, though most people agree, and the police reports show that there were drag queens. It's hard to know how draggy they were, as just a few items of female clothing could prompt arrest. The people that were actually there have argued about the race of the specific people who were there. I've heard people say that the management of the bar kept out black queens, so it's possible most of them were outside and joined in the riot when it moved out of the bar. I've also heard them say that there weren't lesbians usually in the bar, so it's possible the legend of the black butch lesbian throwing the first brick might be just legend. When you see photos from the riots, you see people of various races and gender identity, but I don't think the queens there would necessarily be acceptable to the trans community that we know now. Their way of expressing themselves was probably closer to RuPaul than Julia Serrano. For one thing, the term transgender wasn't really coined until about 1965. These queens would have called themselves transvestites or just queens, more than likely. I remember in the 80s, Connie Norman, who was a trans activist in ACT UP LA, who often referred to the tranny kids for whom she was trying to make the world better, which would be completely unacceptable to trans people now. One thing that bugs me a little, both in the 1995 movie and in this current one, is the way the Mattachine Society is portrayed. It is true that this group was, at the time, rather conservative, but they were also openly gay and picketing government buildings and trying to change and challenge anti-gay laws, along with the Daughters of Bilitis. The Daughters of Bilitis.
Bilitis.
Is it, or
Bilitis.
Bilitis. They may have been conservative by the terms of the younger hippies, but they were incredibly brave. Anyway, sorry for going on and on and on. Love the show. Daniel.
Thank you, Daniel. Well, yeah, and it's funny, speaking of the hippies, like the movie doesn't give you any kind of cultural context that about what late 60s activism looked like, because it's not like the Stonewall Riots existed in this vacuum. They were picking up cues from the anti-war movement and from the civil rights movement and from other people who were staging protests and sit-ins and, you know, even riots. And so none of that comes through in the film as well.
Sorry, now I've lost my way here in my own email, because that's what happens with me.
Do one more, and then do the, we'll list the iTunes.
Okay, if I only have one more, then I'm going to go with the one that subject line says, I agree with Dave.
Oh, that's a long one.
That's not that long.
And they insult me.
Three paragraphs. Oh, does it insult you?
Yes. Not,
let's go!
I'm not going to say I didn't have some criticism coming, but... Well, here, just read it.
Dear Alonso and Dave, this is going to stoke Dave's ego a bit. Good. But I've agreed with him for multiple weeks running. First, American Ultra is everything.
Ugh, can we please drop that piece of junk already?
It's a trashy movie that is putting in all of the discordant tracks of this immediate culture. I'm sorry, all of the discordant tracks of this immediate culture. Casual marijuana emphasis, government paranoia, propaganda, spying, ultra-violence, strong female characters, a casually homosexual character, a sweet romance, government versus government, citizens as pawns, all pulled together in a haphazard stoner rant. It was perfect as a snapshot of current societal concerns and fears. Thanks.
And John Leguizamo as a tired old Hispanic drag queen, a drug dealer stereotype.
Secondly, The Green Inferno is a racist, xenophobic, and misanthropic film. But I had a lot of fun with it, especially by empathizing with the tribe people and looking down on the trademark Eli Roth band of nitwits. Sure, Roth is very confused about what he was saying. He intended to say slacktivism is bad, but then the kids actually went to the jungle to actually do something, and he portrayed the other as callous, murderous cannibals, while completely missing how the construction of the cannibal Holocaust condemned itself for its own message and for existing. But the final result of The Green Inferno is a problematic, grotesque, grand guignol comedy of the absurd. Thirdly, I agree with Dave's points about the Danish girl with regards to the politics of a cisgendered male playing a trans female. Even if trans back then meant something completely different than it does now. I'm sorry. Even if trans back then means something different than it does now. In the original discussion, Alonso and Peter de Bruges reached Roland Emmerich's levels of dismissing... I can't even read right now.
No.
In the original discussion, Alonso and Peter de Bruges reached Roland Emmerich's levels of dismissing concerns of a whole community.
That's the insulting part.
Okay, I don't agree with that.
I will grant I have a learning curve on all this stuff, as I think many of us do.
Yes.
And I think that I'm approaching that learning curve in an attempt to be respectful of other people. So I don't
know. Yeah, no, that's true.
I may not always get the trans stuff right, but I'm trying to. Compare me to Roland Emmerich again, and I'm going to find you, Julius. Because I have my limits. Go on.
Julius, do as you will. That is the whole of the law.
You're the whole of the law.
Dave made good points about having the gender of the actor match the final gender of the role. And in terms of concern, scare quotes intended, over a trans actor not wanting to act out the transition, may I point you to the 24 Outfest film 52 Tuesdays, in which a trans man...
You mean 2014?
2014 Outfest film.
Yes.
What did I say?
You said 24.
Oh, 2014 Outfest film 52 Tuesdays, in which a trans man plays a mother... who transitions to a man. It is just out now on DVD.
Yes, I had forgotten about that. Good movie.
An intriguing movie that proves at least one trans actor has no problem portraying the transition, at least as long as the role is positive. Anyways, loved your entries on the sewers of Paris. I could especially relate to Dave's discovery of the freedom of punk rock. Sincerely, Julius Kassendorf, the Solute. S-O-L-U-T-E. Solute.
I have no idea what that is.
I'm going to look it up.
Why don't you look it up later? We need to wrap things up.
Yeah, we're done.
No, you're going to read the names of the lovely people who left us iTunes reviews.
Oh, that's right. That
because they're awesome. And because the more reviews that we get on iTunes, the more likely people can find the show. Because then that helps us not get buried among the thousands and thousands of movie podcasts there are in the world. So thanks, iTunes reviewers.
Indeed.
And if you have not done so yet, please do. Also,
here
you can subscribe to our show for free on iTunes.
Here they are. Matt in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Buscaglia,
mm-hmm.
D.R.D. Dirdgaman.
I think it's Dr. DGA Man or something.
Dr. DGA Man.
Just a guess.
Dreadgaman. I don't know. I don't know what it is. Gary Coe. I know who that is. Zell TN. The one and only Mrs. Parker. Oh, I'm sorry. The one and only Ms.
Parker.
Parker.
Thank you.
And my favorite name, Blood Pepsi.
Blood Pepsi should get together with Taco Tuesday Weld and Ham Drescher.
Also with our friend, Jew Barrymore.
Oh, right. Yes, yeah. That's a good one, too.
Yeah.
So, all right. Thank you for listening. We are very shortly, like within a matter of days, going to be taping the...
like tomorrow.
Linoleum Knife presents more Linoleum Knife episode for Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. So as soon as that becomes available, we'll be announcing it on Facebook and Twitter. In the meantime, you can PayPal us $1.99 at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com for any of our previous episodes. Including What's Up Doc, The Poseidon Adventure, Josie and the Pussycats, Two for the Road, Clue, The Apple, and hey, the Christmas is coming up, so what the heck, White Christmas and Santa Claus.
Yeah.
Again, you can subscribe to the show for free on iTunes, and do leave us a review, we really do appreciate
it. Yeah, we like them.
Stream us at Stitcher Radio or thelounge.com and leave us positive feedback there as well. Like our Facebook page, join our Linoleum Knife group page on Facebook and talk about movies with other fans of the show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at linoleumcast. And again, our email is linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you to Blue for our awesome theme music. And of course, go listen to all the other podcasts that we always plug every week. But I'm not doing it today because I got to go to a screening. I'll talk to you guys later.
Goodbye.